This is a HeadGum Podcast.
This
episode
is brought to
you
by
Squarespace.
Start
building
your
website
today
at
squarespace.com.
Enter
offer
code
Gilmore Guys at
checkout
to
get
10%
off. Squarespace.
Build
it
beautiful.
Nailed it.
Uh-oh.
How do we stop
doing this?
Look, some people get a headache after drinking wine. Some people get a headache when they shop for the wine in the first place. That's me.
Some people get a headache when you say the word wine.
That's true. That is Kevin.
It's me. I have so much anxiety.
There are too many choices. There's too much to learn, and there's too much money involved in spending it. I don't like spending money.
Yeah, I hate spending money. I love keeping as much as possible.
So how do we do that?
Okay, let's, I got an idea.
Yeah.
Let's join a new wine club called Club W. Let's change it all, man. It's easy. So here's what we do. Go to clubw.com and answer 6 simple questions. And they got an algorithm, which sounds like the former vice president.
Algorithm?
Algorithm.
Sure is.
That's right. The algorithm creates a palate profile, a PP, just for you. They send wine directly to your door, and it's perfectly customized to match your specific taste.
For real. Club W is leading the grape-to-glass wine revolution because they work directly with vineyards to cut out the middlemen and save you that money that you love so much.
I love money.
It's great.
So Club W, you get premium wine customized to your taste at a third of what you pay at the store. It's a real no-brainer, unless you're an idiot and you actually don't have a brain.
We hate you people without brains.
Yeah.
Club W has a 100% guarantee, no risk, that you will love what they send you.
And we got a special offer right now. Go to clubw.com/Gilmore Guys, and you get 50% off your first order.
Now remember, the wine is already a third of what they like what the store is. So for that to be half off of that.
Do the math.
It's crazy good.
It's bonkers good.
And again, that is clubw.com/Gilmore Guys, our podcast name.
So stop wasting time and money messing around at retail stores and start drinking wine you know you're going to love. clubw.com/Gilmore Guys.
Go on.
Go now!
Sip away!
Woo! It kind of sounds like the 60s, yeah.
Pretty good.
We could be in a drum circle right now.
Yeah.
Enacting some political change somewhere in the 1960s. Welcome to Gilmore Gabs, which is our special series of interviews that we do with the cast and the crew of the show. I'm Kevin.
I'm Dimmy.
And we're the Gilmore Guys. Gabs?
Yeah.
Gilmore Gabs.
We don't change who we are?
We are Gabs?
Yes.
It's like we are talk and chatter. Actually makes sense on some level, now that you think about it. Guys, we've interviewed composers. We've interviewed casting directors. We've even interviewed actors. But who is king in television, Demi? When you think of the medium of TV, who rules the medium?
Pen to paper, baby. It's the writers.
It's the writers. So we're going to talk to another writer right now.
La la.
Oh, yeah.
La la. Special guest.
Well, you may know her from her work on Ugly Betty, or Boston Legal, or Bunheads. But you may know her from her work on Gilmore Girls. Ladies and gentlemen, it's
Sheila Lawrence.
Hello. I'm so happy to be here.
We're so happy to have you.
Thank you so much. Just to give a little peek behind the curtain, Sheila was kind enough to bring us all pumpkin spice lattes for the recording.
Aww.
And we are amped and stoked. And we've now made a new rule that all of our guests have to bring us pumpkin spice lattes. That specifically.
Yeah. If it's out of season, too bad.
Yeah. Say, tricky in the summer months, but
It'll be a bummer. But
if people are devoted enough, they'll do it.
If Jason Mantzoukas wants to come on the show again, he'll find a way to get us a pumpkin spice latte. Sheila, thank you so much for doing this show.
Absolutely.
Such a blast to have you. We talked to Jane Espenzin last season.
The lovely and talented.
Lovely and talented. She's kind of like, she's one of those figures in TV writing. And maybe because like I nerded out on all that, like the Buffy DVD extras and all that stuff. But
right.
She seems to be one of those people that's been so like such a great figure and for people to like look up to, and especially women in television writing.
She's amazing. She's the only writer I've ever met who actually like has fans, like a writer on staff, not a creator of a show.
Sure. Right.
But she would get flowers sent to her at the Gilmore offices occasionally because of something she had said on a panel about Buffy. And yeah, writers, especially back then, I think now, like a lovely introduction like you guys gave me is more commonplace. People thank writers more than they used to. They know that there's someone there coming up with the stories and the lines. But back even during Gilmore, I'm like, a writer getting flowers
It'd
for something.
It'd be like a PA getting flowers.
Exactly. Yeah. It was exactly like that. So.
Do you think that, because that shift definitely has happened, and we've talked about so much on this show, where the shift between, there was something, maybe it was like late 90s, early aughts, where the showrunners became equally as public figures as the people in the casts of these shows were. So it's like, it's a Rob Lowe show, but it's an Aaron Sorkin show. You know, like West Wing or Dan Harmon in Community, most famously, or David E. Kelly. Do you think that's better or worse for the industry, that writers are more in the limelight, there's more transparency with Twitter and stuff?
I think it's better for the industry and it's better for the profession. I know for me personally, it's made me slightly even more terrified of ever having a show on the air because you're so in public. I mean, I think writers are writers because we don't want to be out there quite so much.
Sure.
We'd rather be hiding behind the actors who are saying our lines. So I know that for me personally, that part of it is all a little bit daunting. But I do love, though, that showrunner is a word that people know now, not just people in Los Angeles, but, you know, my mother knows that word. It's in Entertainment Weekly all the time. It's a part. I'm curious if it's even like in the Oxford English Dictionary yet, but I feel like it's getting to that point. You know,
a big, huge one that Rory owns.
That's why I was thinking of it. I think this is the first time I have referenced Oxford English Dictionary since writing that on Gilmore Girls.
Was that your first episode?
I think it was, actually.
It was the
debutante episode.
Presenting Lorelai Gilmore.
Yes, that's where Christopher buys her the dictionary, finally.
Mm-hmm.
We made fun of her so much for that, for wanting that. What a nerdy little girl thing.
Well, you should.
But you know what? We got a lot of backlash for that, too.
People were like, have you ever seen it? It's incredible.
They were like, hey, bro, check out an Oxford English Dictionary. It's legitimately awesome.
Nice.
And you know what? I haven't seen a physical one. I just have a Kindle version, so
I just can't see internet.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, definitely old school gift.
Isn't that like a Pete Holmes joke? Like, hey, it's the phone book. We printed out a portion of the internet.
Yeah.
Which is essentially the Oxford English Dictionary. Wow. Well, thank you again so much for doing the show. And one of the goals and aims, because we have so many goals on this show.
So many.
Number one, make them laugh.
Sure.
Get them entertained.
You gotta laugh.
But then number two, like bring insight into what goes into not only creating Gilmore Girls in the show, but what goes into each component and each of the people behind the scenes of the show. Because for the people, Gilmore Girls is just a part of their like own personal or career narrative. Whereas for us, like, oh, so Sean Gunn, oh, that he's the Gilmore Girls guy. But that was just a thing he did. And then he went on and he did stuff before and he did stuff after.
Right, right.
So for Sheila Lawrence, the role that Gilmore Girls plays in the personal Sheila Lawrence narrative. Well, I guess we could just start at the beginning. Like, where'd you come from?
Wow.
Where'd you grow up?
Wow. Okay, sit back. Enjoy those lattes.
Let's do it.
This may take a while. I did not know out of the gate that I wanted to be a writer. So, in fact, I didn't even know. I was one of those kids all growing up and in college who was like, I don't know, maybe an astronaut, maybe an actress, maybe a veterinarian, I don't know.
Or combine all three.
Exactly. I think I thought I could do that. And the first woman president, which sadly no one has still achieved yet, but
not yet. Although there was a Hillary joke even on Gilmore Girls, like,
oh really? I don't even remember.
We just covered the episode
where
it was like season.
It was either fourth or fifth season. Someone said like, well, Hillary's just biding her time until she gets a shot. It was something like that.
Nice. So very nice. But yeah, so at some point in college, as it became clear I was going to have to figure out soon what to do with my life, I started looking back on pretty much every assignment I had done for every class ever, like starting in elementary school, and I would always gear it towards television. So, you know, presenting a book report in fourth grade. I had this character named Hollywood, and I interviewed my friend Beverly Hills about the book. And in junior, I'm such a nerd. And in junior high, for an English class, I developed a game show and recorded it. And then, you know, in college,
You shot it, or did you do like an audio?
It was so long ago. It was an audio recording with my cassette recorder.
So we could play it on this podcast if we got access to the tapes. See, it's all
nice.
Cyclical.
It all comes back. It's true. And see, and suddenly I'm much more at ease. I'm like, this is just like being in seventh grade doing an audio recording.
Well, we have the mental intelligence of two seventh graders put together.
So. All three of us, I think.
Yeah,
so
right.
good. We're in this together. And then up through college, even like I rewrote Job as a soap opera for my biblical heritage class. And
that's brilliant.
Right?
That's so good.
Wait,
I would watch that.
There was even a better one. Okay, so I had one of those, you know, very college-y classes, like sociology of, you know, gender roles in families or whatever. And I wrote a paper. God, it had like a two-line title, like, you know, the primetime television's portrayal of stereotypes and their effect on the socialization of children. And what it basically meant was I got to watch as research lots and lots of television.
Mm-hmm.
So I was watching, you know, 2 hours of sitcoms a night and researching the portrayals of gender stereotypes. And so finally, it started to like become clear to me, like, maybe people have jobs in television, and maybe I could be one of those people.
Because at this time, like we were talking about before, writers, showrunners, those weren't people anybody knew.
No.
So there was no model for you, really.
Absolutely not. And I even grew up in Southern California. I mean, I grew up in the San Diego area, went to school in Pomona, which are, you know, both within a couple hours of here, and knew no one who did this for a living. So it was just, it was sort of baffling to me. But my senior year, the one thing I did know that I would need was some money, because I heard all about paying your dues, and so that sounded like something that was going to be very expensive. So I went on a game show as a contestant, and won.
Do you remember the game show?
Of course I do. It was Scrabble with Chuck Woolery.
There was a Scrabble game show?
Woolery hosted more than wow.
I know. Well, I remember being very strategic about it. I didn't want to be on any show where I could be paired with a celebrity who might weigh me down. So this was one you were just like,
weigh you down.
I'm serious. Exactly. So I won $9,000, and more importantly, gave my resume to the contestant coordinator. I think there were like two things on it, but I'm like, I really want to work in television and I'll do anything. And so after I graduated, they started calling me periodically when they were developing game shows. They would do run-throughs of them to see, you know, what was working, what wasn't. So I would drive up from San Diego, where I was living. I'd be like the buzzer girl. I'd push the buzzer. If a contestant got the answer wrong, they'd pay me $20 and I'd go back home. So, man, I was very excited. This was like the glamour of Hollywood. I'm like, this is the most amazing thing ever.
You're getting to tell people they're wrong for a living.
Exactly. I never thought of it that way. Yeah. It's me going full circle. I would like to go back to that. So that was at least something then legitimate to put on a resume. I'm semi-legitimate. But it was a job, and it was my first job. And then from there, I got hired as a receptionist on a teenage soap opera on Fox. And that was actually 5 days a week, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And the only thing is I made so little money that there was no way I could even get an apartment yet. So I was commuting from San Diego. I had to be in at 8 a.m. Work all day answering the phones. And then, because I really wanted to learn, I would go to set after my shift.
What was the show? What was the teen?
Oh, it was called Tribes. It was,
Tribes.
Yeah, it was only on, it was like on the Fox owned and operated networks. I still don't know what that means, but it was like in seven cities, and Los Angeles was one of them. Yeah.
So not Fox and Fox Family, which didn't exist.
Yeah.
Not Fox Network with Simpsons and all that.
It was the Fox Network because it was the year the Simpsons came out, because they were all around and In Living Color was there. But it was just on in like L.A., Chicago, New York. I don't understand it, but I was excited to have the job. Mm-hmm. And So I commuted for a long time, and then I stayed on people's couches, and then I just, you know, I couldn't take it anymore. And so I noticed that we had some empty dressing rooms, and so I moved in to a dressing room at Sunset Gower Studios. And I always feel like I'm talking about a different person when I tell this story, because I'm like, who was that person? Like, I don't think I would care enough about any job to do that now. But at the time, it made a lot of sense. So I got a gym membership at like Bally's on Sunset to like have a place to shower in the morning. Mm-hmm. And Monday through Friday, I stayed in my dressing room. and the craft services person would like bring me like peanut butter and bread. And it was working perfectly well until
Someone noticed.
Exactly. Well, and that someone was Sunset Gower Management, and apparently that wasn't one of our show's dressing rooms, and so she was bringing a tour through to rent out the space, and she opens the door, and my stuff is, I mean, I have moved in. Oh, I have cut flowers and a stereo and probably like a poster on the wall or something. And I'm trying to convince my boss. I'm like, no, I went to a concert last night and it was really late and it's a bad area. So I didn't want to leave my stuff in the car. So I just brought everything in to the dressing room. Exactly. Yeah. As one does. So miraculously, I didn't get fired. I think they just thought it was like a charming, you know, 21-year-old just doing what they had to do or something. So... I see. I told you this is a very long story, and we are not even to the writing career yet.
It's a very interesting.
It's all important. It's an example for young women everywhere. Move into the dressing room.
Wait. I don't think that was
that's the takeaway. That's what I'm getting.
Yeah. Okay.
Look at her now.
Do whatever you have to do. Mm-hmm. No. So then, about 2 to 3 years later, I had just been doing like every kind of production job, sort of learning about all of the options. So worked in everything from, you know, casting to like production coordinating, location managing, accounting, you know, just getting a feel for everything. And I had quit a job where I had been for about a year and a half. I'd been a producer's assistant. And it was when I took the job, I think I thought the job was assistant producer, which in my head sounded important and right and like that's the kind of thing I should be doing. And then I was shocked that it was actually kind of a secretarial job. But I hung in there and I did it for a long time and kept being promised promotions that didn't happen. And so I finally left without anything else to go to. I was just like, okay, I don't know what I want to do yet, but I know what I don't want to do. And so I thought, okay, let's just clear the space for that.
So TV writer was still
we're getting there. I told you this is and then we're gonna do Lala's right after this and be done with the whole podcast.
Goodbye.
Exactly.
No, but I guess my question is, TV writer at this point was not even the vision.
Not yet.
It wasn't like, I'm rising through the ranks however I can to get there.
No
idea.
Still
not even
yet.
On the board.
Not
the
yet,
board.
But so soon. It is the next step of the story. So unemployed, calling around trying to get jobs, and it's like March or April, and every place I call is like, we just had our rap party last night. We just, you know, I was like, I didn't even know like the sitcom cycle or anything. And so the same week, like someone hit and run totaled my car, and I found out I had to move out of my apartment. I'm like, this is the worst thing I've ever done. And lo and behold, I get a call from a friend who says, do you know anything about being a writer's assistant? And I said, I don't, but I will by tomorrow. So stayed up all night learning how to like format a script because they didn't have final draft or anything like that back then. So it was like, how do you make a dialogue macro for Microsoft? I don't even know what those things mean.
So you had to do all that stuff manually.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
I know, right? So figured it all out. And as soon as I started that job the next day, I walked onto the floor and it was like shaft of light, like chorus of angels. Oh, these are my people. And it's like, oh.
And what was that
show? This is where I was supposed to be. It's a show called Roundhouse. It was on Nickelodeon. You're probably too young.
Roundhouse.
I've
heard of Nickelodeons. The things you would put the quarters in.
Right, the old theaters.
Yeah, see, I get that reference.
It was part of their big SNCC Saturday night lineup.
Yeah.
And with like Clarissa Explains It All. Mm-hmm. And
I remember
SNCC. Dark and Ren and Stimpy.
What
and
was the one with the kid who was the alien?
No, Secret World of Alex Mack.
Oh my gosh.
No. The one where it was the African-American guy who was an alien and they kept him in the attic.
That sounds like a
rock
terrible
from the
show.
Sun, but
I promise
PM,
I'm not
I don't
that.
Know.
It might be a weird fever dream.
Who pitched that? That seems crazy.
Let's keep a black child in the attic.
Exactly.
No, I promise it
America
exists.
America would love it. Oh my God.
I promise it exists. Be that as it may.
Yeah.
Roundhouse.
Okay, sidebar. Yeah. We'll talk about that one later.
Sure.
No, Roundhouse is, other than Gilmore, is my other favorite show that I have worked on.
Really?
It was fantastic. Really talented, I say kids, but like older teenagers, young 20s, singing, dancing, performing, comedy, sketches. And it was just great. It was a great, great show.
It was a sketch comedy show.
A sketch comedy show.
So kind of a forerunner to all that.
Yeah.
It was. It was actually the forerunner to all that.
Okay.
It was just, I'm not even sure. It was Roundhouse was fairly expensive for them to do. And I think there were some issues with those the creators of Nickelodeon who didn't see eye to eye, and so Roundhouse went away, and then out of those ashes, all that was born. So, but if there's it's hard to find now too, because there was so much like music and jingles and like product parodies we did that we didn't clear at all. Like we would do like Beatles songs, and we would do. I mean,
wait. So even at the time it was airing, you didn't clear it.
Never.
Not even like for home distribution
never.
Later.
No.
Wow.
We were like, it's a teeny tiny audience. Whatever. I don't know. There was no thought of it ever.
That's kind of the attitude on our show, actually.
So, but sadly now it means that there are a lot of Roundhouse fans out there, but you can't find it anywhere. Occasionally, like on YouTube, someone will post something. But anyway, so that I was a writer's assistant there, and it was like, oh, this is what I should be doing. And so, true to form, even though I did think this is what I should be doing, I still needed a backup plan. So I applied for a scholarship to do graduate work in Scotland. As one does, I don't know.
Of course, sure.
And I had a very telling couple of days where, like, on a Sunday, I found out I got the scholarship, and on Monday, I finally worked up the nerve to pitch a sketch idea to the head writer. I'd been there for over a year, and he's like, "Yeah, write that up. I'll put it in the show." And for weeks after that, all I talked about was like, "Oh my god, I got a sketch on the show, and yeah, scholarship to go do master's work in Scotland."
Right.
And so, it was like 1 month almost to the date before I was supposed to leave. They made me a staff writer on the show. So, still have not been to Scotland, still no master's degree, but the writing thing has worked out kind of okay.
Yeah. You know, but in a way, I feel like that totally crystallizes like the choice that a lot of writers and people in the industry have to make, where it's like, it's not something that might sound glamorous or understandable for people who aren't writers or in the trade.
Mm-hmm.
It's literally like, I got a sketch on a sketch comedy show. Like, I saw the inside of a writer's room even more rather than I saw the world. Like, that is the choice you made to not go to Scotland, to this exotic place that you may not have had the opportunity to otherwise.
Right. To me, it seemed getting a writing break was the less likely thing to happen. So if I got that, I should seize it. And Scotland would always be there. And
anyone
can go to Scotland. Right. And in theory, I'll, you know, get a master's degree when I retire, you know, in about 5 minutes. And
so, whoa. You
know, no.
It's going to be by the end of this podcast.
So it has been so long since you asked the original question. I don't know if that answered it, but I talked a lot.
No, but that's all part of the Sheila Lawrence origin story. It's like a Marvel movie or a superhero show.
Act one.
So Roundhouse occurred. What year was that?
Oh, God. A long time ago.
We'll say early 90s.
I was going to say early 90s.
Early
90s. Yeah.
And then what is the path to Gilmore? What are the shows that come in between Roundhouse and Gilmore Girls?
Right. So the most notable one was a show called Mad About You with Helen Hunt and Paul Reiser.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. That was my first show after Roundhouse. And I actually took a step back and went back to being a writer's assistant because I lack confidence. So I thought, I want to get into a sitcom writer's room before I try to do that myself. I better figure it out and see what they do. It was kind of silly. But
another Nickelodeon show, Figure It Out.
Oh, nice.
Summer Sand. Oh, boy.
Wow.
But I wonder if there would have been more confidence because you were coming from a cable sketch show to a network sitcom. And the way the playing field is so leveled now, where it's all just content on all the channels, on streaming and stuff, if that would have been more respected, had it occurred now. Because to
we don't
consume things that are on NBC differently than we do on Comedy Central or Adult Swim or Nickelodeon or Nick at Night or whatever.
That's a really good point.
So I wonder.
And certainly now I feel like people who do things for cable or internet or anything are actually more respected creatively than people who do a lot of the network stuff. So,
well, probably just because of the autonomy, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, so at the time I went back to being a writer's assistant and, you know, I beat myself up about that going, oh, that was silly that I wasted that time. But it really wasn't because it allowed me to to really learn the subtleties and nuance of a kind of intense writer's room.
It was intense because it was a hit show at the time.
Yeah. And it was the time when sitcom writing staffs were really huge and there were lots of stand-up comics on them. So it was just a very different environment than the one I had come from.
Well, then you must have heard the infamous Who Jackie story, right?
Oh, God, I have. And I don't remember it, though.
The Roseanne. Oh. We've told it at least once on the show.
Oh, my gosh.
Who Jackie. There's someone who pitches a storyline saying, this is Roseanne's secret sister. And then someone says, oh, no, that's Jackie's, her sister. And the writer goes, who Jackie? And that was like, I think it might have been David Alan Greer. With the identity of who that writer was, it's still
unknown.
Roseanne and Amy Sherman Palladino. Yes, show.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So a lot of stand up. So it's kind of probably an alpha energy.
It was. Yeah. And I'm definitely more of a story person than a joke person. I enjoy both. But in a kind of traditional sitcom room, there was a real kind of line in the sand between the story people who were a little bit second class citizens and the joke people who were the ones on the floor pitching and loud and funny. And
that's so funny. That was the divide.
I know.
At that time.
Yeah. It really was.
Does that really exist now in sitcom writers' rooms? Or
I don't know. No, because I haven't done a sitcom in so long.
Yeah.
That situation wasn't ideal for me. You know, that it's weird because Mad About You, I still love content-wise. Like, that was a show I was a fan, much like Gilmore, I was a fan of before I worked there.
Mm-hmm.
I loved that it was character-driven comedy, there's a lot of realism to it. But then from that show, I then went on a bunch of sitcoms that were just kind of just about the joke. And like, mm-hmm. I always remember, you know, they'd be like, oh, this character has too many jokes, so give some of their jokes to this character. And it was like, wait, okay, I'm in the wrong place.
if lines are interchangeable,
then our characters are really not very specific. I completely lost my train of thought. This is one of those parts we'll edit out, right?
Just the journey. Yeah, exactly. The journey between Roundhouse. I almost said Roundtree for some reason.
Roundtree.
That's a different thing. But Roundhouse, there was Mad About You.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of other different sitcoms. Anything notable in between Mad About You and Gilmore?
No, not even a little bit. a show called Work With Me, which was Kevin Pollak and Nancy Travis and Emily Rutherford and Ethan Embry, about two married lawyers working together.
The title's two meanings. I get it.
But I explained it just in case.
You know what's funny? Because we kind of did this a little bit with Jane, too, is like some of these sitcoms that's like they were on for a season or less than that, mm-hmm. and then they kind of went away. A lot of them sound fake. Like they're like 30 Rock parodies, or like that someone thought it, but they were really real.
Absolutely.
Like Work With Me starring Kevin Pollak sounds like that's like a cutaway.
Exactly.
Oh yeah.
You're absolutely right.
Which is so funny.
And I think that kind of that whole era of sitcoms, with the exception of the really good ones like, you know, Seinfeld and Friends, but a lot of the sitcoms of the 90s, I think, were that. Even the ones that made it on air were the kind of terribly titled, generic, any character can say anything kind of sitcoms. So for me, I needed to, and this is getting to the Gilmore Girls transition, I needed to write a new spec. And at that time, right now, showing original material is what's in fashion. But at that time, you had to write a spec of an existing show. That's what people wanted to read for staffing. So I needed to write a new spec. And there were literally no half hours that I wanted to do. And there was a show on at the time, an hour long, called Ed, starring Tom Cavanaugh.
Yeah.
It was a charming small town show where he was a bowling alley lawyer. But it was really like quirky characters, funny, but an hour. So I'm like, I'm going to write a spec Ed. And my agent at the time was so confused. He's like, whoa, wait, so you want to be a drama writer now? And I'm like, well, no, I just want to write something that I'll write well. I think it's funny, and it could also be used for half hours mm-hmm. and for hours. And he's like, no, I think you should write, you know, Just Shoot Me. Or, you know, I'm like, well, I could write a really terrible Just Shoot Me, or I could write a good Ed.
Yeah.
So I wrote the pretty decent Ed that ended up getting me a lot of work, and the first of which was Gilmore Girls. That was what they read and responded to. And that year, again, it wasn't a conscious decision to do hour-longs. It just happened to be material-wise, that was the show on the air that I responded to the most, that I liked the most.
Right. And that kind of encapsulates a lot of the what was happening at the turn of the century, mm-hmm. if I can use such a lofty. but around 99, 2000, I feel like, you know, Scrubs came on the air, which is a half hour that's very funny, but no studio audience, and mm-hmm. it's very dramatic in parts, and Sports Night, that was another weird kind of genre-bending show.
Yeah.
Ed being one of them. I remember being stoked when Sabrina Lloyd from Sports Night went on Ed at some point.
I love her.
She's awesome. So it was kind of just like your agent was confused, like, wait, you want to do drama versus comedy?
Yeah.
Whereas now, they're literally so versatile and interchangeable that Orange is the New Black was two different genres 2 years ago.
Right.
You know?
I always wonder if they're going to eventually change the categories on the Emmys to, like, half hour and hour as opposed to comedy and drama. It's something I ponder when I'm trying to fall asleep.
Oh, that's interesting.
And, I don't know. There'd be pros and cons, but it's sort of like I personally hate the idea that all half hours have to be comedy and all hours are drama.
Sure.
You know?
Well, because Transparent. It's not a comedy. It's a great show.
Comedy.
It's not a comedy.
Nurse Jackie, not a comedy. Again,
exactly.
Love the show. Love
that's
it.
That's about how they pitch it, right? Like how they want it to be considered just because they think they have a better chance.
Yeah, they look at what they're up
against. It's always the odds.
Tonally.
That's why Orange was the two different things. Mm-hmm. I always thought a good new Emmy category would be just best news show. What was the best first year show of the season?
Yeah.
Because then instead of like, okay, so there's these certain shows that have monopolies on best drama or best Modern Family 6 years in a row or whatever. Mm-hmm. West Wing was 4 years in a row. Mad Men was 4 years in a row. Just give a best new show. So someone who's new to the table still gets recognition, but you don't diminish the old veterans and the old guard, and you can still
I love that.
Vote the lazy way you want.
Well, the Writers Guild does that.
Oh,
they do a best new show. And, in fact, Ugly Betty got it when I was working there. So that was a nice thing to get to do. But I love the idea of doing that at the Emmys.
Pitch it to the
WGA. I was going to say, I nominate you for Emmy president.
Thank you. And host.
Exactly.
So for Gilmore, they read your ed spec.
Mm-hmm.
And who, and this may be, I feel like these nitty gritty details are interesting, though.
Uh-huh.
At least that's what we're banking on in doing this podcast. Who do you know who read your spec? Who's the one that responded to it? Was it Amy?
I think it was eventually Amy, but it was first usually like a gatekeeper type person.
Sure.
Right.
Reads, because there's so many scripts
to make
that come
sure
in.
You're not crazy. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, and there's a lot of because I became that gatekeeper person the next 2 years when I was while I was there. I did a lot of the initial reading to just kind of weed out and then go, oh, here's one I think you'll like. Here's one I think you'll like. So it was Amy's assistant, who I think had been Gavin Pallone's assistant even before that. A woman named Jamie, who's she made sure to always tell me like, I'm the reason you're here. I told them your script was good. And I probably do owe her a lot. I think I never even gave her a gift. So
that is a funny kingmaker position.
I was just thinking that.
Pumpkin spice lattes.
Exactly.
Who wouldn't love it?
The people are going to think we're being sponsored by Starbucks somehow for this.
True. Yeah, Starbucks, call us.
Starbucks, we love you. That's very on brand for our show.
Nice.
For
very
Gilmore.
Nice. Very nice. Exactly. Yeah, that's true.
So she read it, and eventually Amy read it.
Yeah.
And then after that, when it's like, oh, she's got the stuff. She's got talent. Is there an interview process to make sure that you would gel well with the staff?
Yes. But the meeting is actually with Amy and Dan. Mm-hmm. I still remember it vividly. It was just one of those great chemistry meetings. We just got along really well. And it's interesting, knowing them now, I'm like, oh, well, of course they responded to my ed. I had a lot of references in it and a lot of pop cultural
That's
stuff,
funny.
Weirdly.
Yeah.
And I just remember we just completely hit it off on a personal level, and I think I was going to the U2 concert that night, and they're like, "Oh, we just went last night, and make sure you see PJ Harvey who's opening." I'm like, "Oh, well," and we just got along great. And I remember at some point,
PJ Harvey, that makes sense.
Yeah. So it was we were just chatting for a long time and about their travels to Italy and just whatever. And finally, Amy is like, "So, do you like the show?" and it was wonderful to be able to genuinely gush, because in a lot of these meetings, obviously, you're never going to be like, "I don't really care for the show, but I need a job," you know?
Hope
so you
not.
Have to be like, "Oh, it's hilarious. It's great.
Right.
I like, you know." But this one, I remember being conscious of not wanting to sound insincere, like, because I loved the show so much.
Mm-hmm.
But I loved the complex mother-daughter relationship, because I feel like all of us women, especially, either, you know, you come from a complex mother-daughter relationship where they're like watching this fantasy version, or they actually had that and relate to it, you know. Anyway,
it is a weird dualistic thing that it does on the show, where it's like, here's the realism of what a lot of I feel like my mom even relates to, like, the Emily Lorelai dynamic.
Interesting.
And then there's the escapism aspect. So it's like, here's what's probably true and here's what we would like it to be.
Absolutely.
Maybe on some level.
Absolutely.
So as a viewer, as someone who just watched the show before you were interviewed, that was probably the thing you responded to the most?
It definitely, because it was the fantasy mother-daughter relationship that I had always wanted, and love my mom to death. But I, you know, during teen years especially, I remember many fights of like, why can't you just be my friend? And she's like, I'm your mother. I can't be your friend, you know? And so then to sit like, that's still, yes.
And now Dars can say, Yes, you can. Watch Gilmore Girls.
Exactly.
It's doable. Exactly. There's now an example for young daughters across America and the world to appeal to for that sort of relationship.
But the fact is, while there are mothers and daughters who go, "That they're so us." I mean, I think the vast majority of people who love the show, mothers and daughters who like it, it is the escapist thing. Mm, it is the thing that is not generally a real relationship. So so I related to that, but I still remember the very first time I watched the show even. The first thing that caught my attention was Sam Phillips. I was a big Sam Phillips fan. And, you know, she wasn't incredibly well known. And I'm hearing her voice and going, okay, there must be people behind this show who think similarly to me. Like, I just remember the very first thing that caught my attention. And then obviously the character stories world.
Yeah, and just like you guys shared the taste of like U2 and PJ Harvey, sharing the taste of Sam Phillips, the more specific it is, it seems more meaningful. So if it's like, Demi, I saw this sketch on Funny or Die and it has like 300 views and he loves the same sketch.
Right.
Then that's way more like, whoa, oh my gosh, amazing.
Yeah.
And I think because the Sam Phillips is so distinct on that show.
Oh my gosh.
Because in general, I would say, and maybe it's turning a little bit now, but most network, I would venture to, even the best shows, most network 1 hour scoring is not good and lacks even distinct voice.
It's not good, and it's wall to wall not good. Like, I can't even watch most dramedies now, including many of them that I worked on, because it's just like watching a long bad music video. You're like, it never just quiet. Could you just turn it down just a little bit? So
given the space.
Oh God,
because there was so much silence on Gilmore too.
Absolutely, yeah. I haven't gone back and watched Gilmore in a long time, but I would like to, and I have a feeling that's one of the things that would really stand out in a good way now. Like, oh, you just get to like be in the moment of the scene, and as opposed to having your emotions dictated to you by some cheesy music cue.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the episode we just covered, 509, ends with Emily Gilmore coming home after a date because her and Richard are separated.
Oh, God.
And she just weeps, and there's no music, and it cuts to black. And that sort of stuff.
That's cable.
We always say that. It's cable.
Oh, my God.
And it totally just like underlines it and puts a point on it in a way that music would not. And even as a young viewer when I was growing up watching it, that's something I really responded to. Like, because it's almost like a rest when you're expecting a bunch of 16th notes. It's like, this is different. Yeah, yeah, and it really accents it in a unique way.
Yeah, and I'm going to guess, I don't know, but I'm going to guess Amy had to really fight for that kind of stuff too, because it wasn't done, you know? And especially on a network like WB, you know, which was a little happier than that, and you know, wanted things wrapped up a little more neatly, I am sure.
Right. There's not a lot of grandmas crying to end WB shows.
Exactly.
or what if that was
crying
like,
grandmas.
Maybe that was a theme week. Like, you know how NBC has Green Week and they make all the
watch an old lady cry.
Week. Sad grandma week.
Yeah. Tragedy Tuesday.
One Tree Hill. Watch your grandma cry.
Oh, worst theme ever.
So you interviewed with Amy and Dan. Was this after the first season had concluded or in the middle of it?
After the first season had concluded.
Okay, so this was during the break.
Yeah, it was during the break. And so we had a great interview, and I was less than 5 minutes away from the lot when I got the call in my car.
Beautiful.
That they wanted to offer me the job, which was amazing. Mm-hmm. It was nice that they thought it went as well as I did.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
So then you
were on board beginning of season two.
Mm-hmm.
Seasons 2 through 4, correct?
Yeah.
So what was in season two, I guess, when the show, I mean, I'm interested in every season, but season two, was the attitude in the writer's room always, we're doing okay, but the show is always kind of on the bubble and every season could be our last? Like, what was the tenor in terms of like the security or comfortability of the job?
It's such a good question. And I don't remember that well, to be honest. What I remember hearing how hard season one was. I remember a lot of like, you're so lucky you're here now. This was from the other writers. Mm-hmm. Last year was so hard. This is so much better. You know, the first year of a show, trying to find what it is really, really challenging. So I feel like season two, internally, it seemed like things had smoothed out a bit. Amy probably wasn't having to fight quite as much for everything, but still a lot. I don't remember at the time thinking that much about ratings and are we going to be picked up or not. But I think, I mean, I had come from three different jobs in 2 years, I think. So I was very much in the mindset of just don't spend a lot of money and, you know, sure. just be ready to pack up your office at a moment's notice. So that was never my biggest concern personally. So,
right.
And I don't think on that show we would have done, you know, on other shows, it's like, oh, our ratings are terrible. We better bring
pull
in.
Out all the stops.
Exactly. Right. And that's not how Amy and Dan think. So, right. you know, it never would have been like, what can we do to entice the young viewers? Let's get some more hot guys. You know, it's just not what they do. Like,
yeah.
so.
And they got plenty. So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They raise them on the WB farm.
Well, that's an interesting. Yeah. there's so many fictional, like,
oh
the
God.
WB stable of hot boys.
Exactly.
That's one thing Amy referred to. She said there's a warehouse of hot men.
Conveyor. Belts.
Farm, Sheila says. I mean, they're coming from all over the place.
Yes, indeed.
So. Well, that's an interesting insight that the security mm-hmm. of the job, better or worse, did not affect storytelling. Because I feel mm-hmm. like on a lot of shows, some shows always retrofit their season finales to be series finales,
oh,
et cetera.
Yeah.
You know, I think Hannibal did that every year that yeah. it was on because it was really on the bubble.
Of course. No, so, a lot of shows that I've worked on have done that, and I don't right. recall that ever being the case at Gilmore Girls. So.
And who was the crew when you first joined up? It was Amy and Dan.
Yeah.
And then who were your fellow writers?
Season two, John Stevens, who lasted through season four, so we were on staff together for a long time. And then Joan Binder-Weiss and Linda Guzik, I think we're both on staff from season one and into season two, but not after mm-hmm. that. And I may be forgetting someone, but that may be it. And then there were some like revolving seats. So
sure.
people that came in and out pretty quickly. So, but it was really season three, season four, I felt like in the writer's room, they I don't know how to say this. Like season two, I felt like Dan and Amy still weren't 100% sure they had gotten the right mix of writers for the show, you know, and it's a tricky show, obviously, to get voice wise and to mesh with them personality wise. And it's just everything about it is very specific.
Sure.
So we had a lovely room, but it didn't feel the same way season two as it did in like three and four. Once we really got kind of a core group who worked well with Amy and Dan, and they responded well to us, and I feel like that's sort of when we, as a staff, hit our groove.
And that was the sweet spot.
It was.
Okay,
it was.
So who were the newcomers in season three?
I will mess up which season
that's
was
fine.
What for one
in
person.
That period,
but the
sure.
staff that I always think of was actually probably more in four, but well, Janet Leahy, John Stevens, Jane Espenson,
sure.
and myself, we spent a lot of time together. And I don't know if it was just one season or two seasons, but we spent a lot of time in that room together. And being such a small staff, you know, you get to know each other and each other creatively and personally really, really well.
Yeah. Was that uncommon for the staff to be so small for a show like that? Are there usually more writers
well,
for hour long?
It was uncommon for me because at its height, Mad About You had 19 writers.
Oh,
so
gosh.
This
wow.
was
that's
quite
like late night or
a
something.
Departure. Yeah, exactly. That was the last season of Mad About You where they suddenly decided, like, let's get a whole bunch of young, like, you know, junior writers yeah. in to just generate thousands of ideas. And it didn't work very well. But I feel like that was a smaller staff than usual at the time. Now it's pretty common because budgets have shrunk so much. But at the time, I think that was definitely on the small side. But I think that's also how Amy and Dan like to work. You know, mm-hmm. that even though they come from sitcom and certainly can hold their own in those kind of rooms, we never had a room where we were like punching up the script in the room and people shouting out jokes or anything like that. You know, even after a table read, you know, we would mark any thoughts we had or cuts or whatever just on a script and hand it to them, and they would like look through on their own and see if there was anything they wanted to use. But we didn't ever have the kind of loud, raucous room full of people. So
that'd be funny.
Oh, God.
Oh, the Gilmore Girls rooms have another party down the lot.
What if Rory goes back to that other guy? No, she can't do that. It's like a stock trading floor.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Wolf of Wall Street style. So the process for writing an episode,
mm-hmm.
so something like, was it after Boom? Was that your last credited
oh,
episode?
God.
That was like 4:19. It's okay. It's okay. Sure. Fine.
I know my first one.
So.
Okay,
yeah.
then it must be true.
So for something like that, so that's like in the middle of the groove, the season three, season
yeah.
four. So you're assigned the episode
mm-hmm.
to write.
Yeah.
Do you go off and write it? Like Jane told us a little bit of this, but I'm always interested in
yeah.
hearing it from everyone's perspective.
Sure.
Like how it worked.
Yeah. Well, let's I mean, why don't I talk a little bit about just how the how we looked at the season as a whole? Because that's super interesting. And then go down to the individual episode. So say we had, I don't know, a 22-episode season. We would normally, over the summer, you know, writers start earlier than everyone else to get a jump on things. And so we would always do a story retreat every summer to Las Vegas. Not sure why Poolside Cabana in Las Vegas was where we had to work.
But and that was every year.
Every year. So that was what we did. It was our Vegas trip. We did water aerobics every day. We're like, we had our routine down. And then, you know, broke stories by the pool and then went to drinks and then went to dinner and then went gambling. So that was, I don't know. So and I think we just didn't want to mess with that. That was how we did it. But we would always look at like the first 13 episodes because looking at a chunk of 22 is just that's
you can't even.
So we'd break it down to the first 13. And even though I said a minute ago that they would certainly wouldn't let ratings affect what they did creatively, you did look at like what are the sweeps episodes, you know, because that's important that if you have some big things that are going to be happening, that those would happen during sweeps. Right. So we'd think about that. And you just get kind of tent poles for each character, like, oh, okay, you know, we know Rory and Jess are going to break up. So let's have that happen around 13. And then we know for the second half of the season, it can be recovering from that or, you know, whatever. So we'd get a lot of good, again, just tent poles from which to build stories. And then we could go back. And kind of the way we worked with Amy and Dan throughout was always, you know, they were in the room a lot, but they also were demanded everywhere else a lot. So, you know, they would come in, they'd see what we had done, they'd give notes, make it better, give us new direction. They would leave, we would implement all that. They'd come back, you know, it was a very kind of fluid process that way. So once we started getting close to around episode 13 and, you know, running out of all the things we had done in pre-production, we would take a fall retreat somewhere. It was always very
Vegas
important for
again.
Us to go away. No, fall retreat, yeah. Not Vegas ever.
Oh.
La Jolla, Palm Springs. Paladinos like to do things right. They enjoy living their lives.
Yeah,
so,
that's fun.
but the most important thing was we would get Amy's undivided attention. I mean, that was really the reason for it because when production was going on, you know, showrunner, and especially a showrunner who is so crucial to the voice of the show,
she
was demanded in 20 places at once. So we would get her for a whole weekend to weigh in on everything that, like, we would bring to the retreat, everything that we started to think about for the back half of the season. You know, how about this? How about that? We were thinking this. And to finally get her seal of approval or her no way or, you know, just get more clues about what's going on in her head. That was always what we were kind of fishing for. So that was kind of the overarching process of how we looked at the whole season. Then once we got into breaking episodes, you know, on some shows you come in and if you pitch the idea, you write it. But on this one, it was sort of just more, I don't know, when it was your turn again. Like, I mean, Dan and Amy obviously wrote a majority of the episodes. Each of us usually wrote two. And obviously, I use the term "wrote" kind of loosely, but
because you would write it, and
Amy, you know, does her pass on it, which I give her huge credit. In that same wonderful meeting that I talked about, I mean, she made a point of saying, "Just so you know, every script goes through, you know, my typewriter,
the Paladino
pen.
Machine."
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And she's like, you know, and if that's not okay,
so
with
it wasn't
you,
a gotcha. So, or
no,
like, yeah.
No. She was absolutely upfront about that. So then I'm trying to think. So you would just kind of you just start to know when, you know, you might be getting another script again. And usually it would just be one in the first 13 and one in the back ones. But then the staff, you know, was very involved in the break of every single episode. With that small a staff, and again, with Amy so busy all the time, we broke the stories in more detail by far than any show I have ever worked on.
I wish I had small writing on the blackboards. Tiny
writing on three giant whiteboards.
I would love to see pictures.
I wish I had taken them. Well, I had never worked, you know, on an hour long before, and I didn't know how unusual this was. I thought, oh, I guess this is how they do it, an hour long. And also I thought, oh, hour long shows are always 80 pages, I guess. So, you know, imagine my shock. And then I, you know, later went to Ugly Betty and it was like, oh no, it has to be under 50. Under 50.
Right.
That's like two acts.
Yeah.
So, so we would break in tremendous detail. And I feel like that, you know, I'm going to be careful in how I say this. I mean, the show is so much Amy's voice and no one can do what she and Dan can do. But the staff, I think, really helped her to do that by figuring out a lot of the mechanics of every single scene, you know, because we would break it in so much detail, you know. Lorelai and Rory walk into Luke's, they sit down, they order blueberry pancakes, you know, whatever.
Right.
But Lorelai makes a joke about blueberries. It's just, it was a lot of detail. again, incorporating a lot of what Dan and Amy were pitching to us when they would come in the room and hear what we were doing and, you know, whatever. But
so it's almost like they're saying, I want to get to point X. Mm-hmm. And then the writers in breaking those stories and the teeny tiny scribblings on the blackboards or the whiteboards draw a map, essentially, to X.
Yeah.
That's like, well, you got to turn left here. Take a right here, go a mile down there to get it to an organic place.
Yes, but it doesn't go just from idea to super detailed in one pass. Like, okay. What we would always do, it'd be, you know, we'd start with like the broad strokes. Like, what are the beats we know we want to see? Dan was always very good at doing that. It's something I still do when breaking a story. You know, even when you don't know every detail, but you know, like, okay, we definitely, you know, want to see a kiss at the dance marathon. That didn't happen, but I'm just, you know, whatever. We want to see this. We want to see that. And you just kind of put those up. And then we'd kind of start talk about those, then erase, and then put a little more detail on each beat and kind of land on that, and then erase. And then it's like, okay, we're ready to start scene by scene. You know, so it was just, to go from just idea to extreme detail in one step would be way too hard.
Sure.
I'm just thinking, in breaking stories there, it was really interesting learning what was considered enough story for them. Because I remember even the very first episode, I think it was that I was writing, it was debutante, and I remember they came back into the room and I'm like, guys, I don't know. It seems like we have act one and act four, but there's just no middle here. I don't know what it is. And they looked at all it was again, just the broad stroke beats that we had on the board. They're like, yeah, no, that's right. What? How could this be enough? How could, you know, just didn't, yeah. Like, I didn't know yet. I didn't have the feel. There's a lot of that show that's just, you just have to feel
instinctual.
It. Yeah, because it's not in story breaking books. So.
Right. Like, for instance, one of the things we talk about on the show that's so unique mm-hmm. is the way that there would not be act breaks per se.
No.
Oh, was that a famous thing?
Like, or just very small ones, you know?
Yeah, it
just.
Like, I need a Danish, Luke.
Exactly.
Go to commercial.
Absolutely. I mean, not always, but I did like that Amy was not a slave to ginning up a giant act break, because I think that hurts a lot of dramedies now. I think
sure
your attention is taken away from the small emotional story you actually care about for some just big stupid act break that you're like, what? I don't even, right. Okay.
Yeah, because it can be like three false climaxes.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, okay.
Yeah.
Well, and especially in rewatching it, mm-hmm. streaming or DVD, or which is the majority of
right.
how people consume it over time, it kind of plays better without it,
I'm
without
sure.
the act break lines, because then it just becomes like a Woody Allen movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
In terms of like, okay, and here's the next scene. It's kind of brilliant the way they did on Frasier too, where they would fade up and down between all those scenes, because then you, when rewatching it, you don't know the difference between a commercial break versus just the end of that scene.
Yeah, so I didn't even think
cool.
about that
yeah.
with Frasier. That is really interesting. Yeah, I mean, it feels, you know, that's why I like, you know, Amazon shows or Netflix or any of those,
yeah.
because again, they're not slaves to
it's
the,
over when
to
it's
the
over.
Act breaks.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So it seems like you kind of had to relearn certain rules or just think of them in a different way.
It was more, if I may, it was
sure.
more that I had to then learn the rules once I left Gilmore, because again, I hadn't written on hour-longs before.
True, yeah.
So, I mean, Dan and Amy both come from half hour, and I think at half hour you do much smaller, more observational stories. You don't need something to carry, you know, six acts or whatever. Sitcoms don't tend to be super, super plotty, you know, at least not the ones I worked on. So Gilmore just kind of felt like a longer, talkier version of that. And then I went on to other dramas, and it was very, very different. Like, though, you know, like in Gilmore, it was okay to just talk about things. And then you go, you know, anywhere else in the world, and it's like, oh, you're supposed to see the thing happen. Oh, okay, that's drama, you know.
Right.
So it was more, Gilmore didn't strike me as unusual until I left there. And then I realized how unique it was.
Because it was such a new experience.
Yeah, exactly.
So do you feel like the majority of the creative contribution happened in the breaking and the super detailed stuff for most of the writing staff?
100%. So, and that's very different from, I think, most of the hours that I have worked on, or most other hours, period. You know, normally when your show says written by, you've actually written a good chunk of it and produced it and were on set for it. And Gilmore, that's not where we were involved, but I feel like all of us saw our handprints all over every episode, mm-hmm. just in kind of the fabric of the show. Certainly mined from all of our personal lives.
Do you remember any personal stories that ended up the show?
It was more just moments. I don't remember huge ones. I mean, things like I had a crappy job as the meal card swiper. That was me. So pretty much if anything embarrassing or humiliating happened that you revealed in the writer's room, it was going to somewhere be on the show.
That's fine. So. Yeah, wasn't it... do you remember who it was that had the night terrors that they used for Kurt?
I do. Yes, it was one of our writers who, and I don't even think he would mind me saying, but there were so many stories about those night terrors. We were all terrified for him. And they were riveting stories.
So how did those stories come out? Was it just like, because I imagine that there's got to be some analogous to just, you're having a conversation, you're just telling old stories and talking about growing up. Yeah. Or was it like, this needs this sort of scene or this sort of character beat? What do you got?
That is more typical to other shows. Mm-hmm. But on this one, no, it was a little more organic. It was just in the downtime of chatting.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
And again, the benefit of a small staff where you all know each other really well. You all get a lot of chance to just talk because we were in that room a lot. We didn't go to set ever on that show. So we were just always in
that
the room.
That is unusual for most writers on writing staff.
Exactly. So, Amy spent a lot of time on set, but mm-hmm. we were always in that room. So you start just knowing everything about each other. And on a show like that, there's some shows where it's like, okay, 10 o'clock we start. And then, we just talk about the scenes at hand until lunchtime. And then on a show like this, I think it really benefits from the richness of things that have actually happened to people. And I will say Dan and Amy, Dan in particular, they're very good at drawing stuff out of you. Dan asks a lot of questions. If you just mention a thing, he's like, wait.
See that.
Okay, let's go back to that, and gets you talking. And then next thing you know, Rory is the meal card taker. So.
That's so funny. Do you remember in those story breaks, and you may not, it's been so long, but like a logistical thing that you guys were trying to crack and like, we need to get this. We don't quite know how to get there. And then there's like an aha moment. It may not be that clear.
No. I have one. And it's weird because it sounds very self-promoting because it's one where I cracked it, so I'm the hero of the story.
Well, you remember it, yeah.
And that is why I remember it, because I remember one time, and it was in an episode that I wrote where it's called "There's the Rub." It's where Lorelai and her mom and Emily go off to a spa.
Yes, the bathrobes.
Yes, exactly. And they end up, bonding and having this great time, but then they go to the bar, and Emily is flirted with by Hal Linden's character, and she starts to turn and she starts to blame Lorelai. How dare you have taken me out here? It's like the whole night, all the good stuff, all the gains that they had made in their relationship just went away, and she pulled it all back. And I remember in the room, we were trying to figure out what happens next after the flirting, what happens. And for some reason, we were in the area of Emily and Richard. We kept thinking like, so does Emily confess it to Richard and then he gets mad? Or does Richard show up or does whatever? And none of those were feeling right. And I think this may be my only aha moment ever. So that's why it's sticking. And it also because I believe as a writer, a lot of times you're writing emotionally, autobiographically. So details are different, but you remember the emotion. So I remembered a time I first thought, we shouldn't be making this about Richard. This is all, the whole episode is about Lorelai and Emily. I think we're off by looking to Richard. And so then I was thinking about Lorelai and Emily, and I thought about a night my mom and I had, and we'd always had, some friction in our relationship, and she came to visit and we had this great, great night. It was so much fun. And, it was 1 a.m, we were still up and probably drinking and talking, and I asked a question, something I'd always wondered about, and she was sort of shocked that I asked it and laughed it off. But then the next day, I got the email, the angry email, you crossed a line, how dare you have asked me that, And and I just remember just feeling so like, shoot, I thought we had made some progress in our relationship. We'd reached this new point where we could actually be open with each other and fun, and it could be okay. And then she just pulled it all back. And so that was sort of what I wanted with Emily and Lorelai. I'm like, the fight should be with them. And it should be that Lorelai let herself get taken in and they go, hey, I'm actually having fun with my mom. And then Emily not only shuts it down, she even blames Lorelai for everything about
it.
So that was my own favorite aha moment and favorite way of being able to use my own stuff to inform a scene.
Yeah. Probably the most relevant stuff you could, like mother, daughter, complicated conflict. Was that one of the most fun, or I'll say it like this. Mm-hmm. What was one of the most compelling sort of conflicts for you to spend time on writing on the show? Even the dynamics, would it be Rory and her boyfriends? Was it Emily and Lorelai or Lorelai and Rory?
Right. I wish it were more interesting than this, but Emily and Lorelai were definitely my favorites to write. Their banter is so much fun. I mean, Lauren is obviously amazing, but I absolutely love Kelly Bishop too, and loved writing for her on Bunheads as well. She's so funny. Yeah. She's so good.
We had a little bit of time with her, and she.
Oh, yeah, nice.
She's wonderful.
Yeah, she's great. Writing their scenes. The conflict, but not even the super angry conflict, more just the conflict that underlies just like the nice scenes even.
Yeah, the subtext.
Yeah. Their subtext is great to write.
Because there actually is a shocking amount of subtext on this show. Mm-hmm. Things that are not literal. There's so many, almost in the way where on Mad Men, it seems like in every scene, there's what's happening and then there's what's happening inside.
Exactly.
And you have to read the characters and it's like, well, what is Don Draper or Peggy actually thinking,
right,
or like, how are they, you know, processing this? That exists so much on Gilmore in ways that I think people don't often, in retrospect, give it credit enough for doing.
I think it's second viewing kind of stuff, especially like the Friday night dinners. You know, I think those were all,
past
the chicken, but that's not what that was about. You know?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and we'd be remiss, and we got chastised the last time we didn't do it.
Uh-oh.
If we didn't ask Team Jess.
Oh, I was afraid it was that question. That's the thing I've been most nervous about. I'm going to answer that question.
Dean. Well, you can be team none of them.
Logan.
Or team Marty, or team
Dark Horse Marty.
It could be team Tristan,
Marty.
Team Trenton.
Oh my God.
You can
team
be team
Tristan.
I mean, there are some people who are like, well, he's the proto Logan. So.
Well, kind of, yeah. I am team nobody. I feel everyone served a purpose in Rory's growth as a character and young woman. I understand why she was attracted to each of them at the time that she was. That made sense to me. But if I were her mother, I wouldn't want her ultimately with any of those people.
Sure, right.
Yeah, I know everyone is Team Jess, but like, I personally was never as into Jess as the rest of the world. I understood it kind of intellectually.
You understood the appeal. Yeah.
The bad boy thing, but that's not my thing. So I was just kind of like, really? But then I didn't think Dean was such great shakes. He was a great first boyfriend. And then Logan, again, good to just for her to experience a totally different kind of situation. No, there's none of those. Like if the Gilmore movie came to exist, I wouldn't want to see her
Sheila's
with any of those boys.
Confirming the Gilmore movie.
Exactly.
Put that on people.
Put it on people.com.
Oh my God. I wish. I would be really disappointed if she were with any of them.
Any of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, nice. For the revival or something
exactly,
like that.
Exactly. Exactly. The musical.
Oh, the Gilmore Girl. Well, yeah, wouldn't it?
I think that'd be kind of interesting.
There was some musical type. Well, that's one of the things we've actually talked about on the show, is how a lot of the show, because it's in Masters and Long Winters and stuff, a lot of it's staged theatrically.
Absolutely.
Almost like it was a musical. Was that reflected at all in the writing, or I guess those are like on-set choices?
I don't think we really thought that much about it, or at least I didn't, because this was all new to me, and I'm like, I guess this is just how it's done, everywhere. No.
So season 4, that was your final season with the show.
Yeah.
And then you went from that job to... Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh, where did I go to? I went to a show called Clubhouse, and I want to say it was a tough decision to leave the show, and in fact...
Yeah, what contributed to that?
Well, you know, it is such a specific show. I started to worry that if I spent too much time there, I would forget how to tell a story in other places. I would not realize that Rory loses a bracelet doesn't serve as an A story on most other shows.
That is true.
I mean, and I started to think, maybe it's time to move on before, you know, this very specific style is what I
becomes
think everything
second nature.
Is. Exactly. So, but it was a tough decision. And I actually just texted Amy a few months ago. I'm like, I think I made a mistake by leaving Gilmore Girls. I'm so sorry. She called me pathetic. So, so yes.
You don't say. That doesn't sound like Amy
at
all.
No, no, no. I adore her.
All
and she
fun.
She and Dan very kindly met with me at the end of season 5 and asked me to come back season 6 as an exec producer. And they're like, look, we don't have a deal in place for season 7, so, you know, if we're not there, you could take over the show. And I'm like, okay, first of all, you're not going anywhere.
Wow.
Which turned out to be wrong, but I was like, you're never leaving the show. Right. Secondly, who on earth would take that job? That is such a losing proposition.
Yeah, it's not good.
No one will ever like it. No, I would never think that I could do what they do. Ever, ever, ever. So, and you know what? And I don't slam season 7. I watched it still as a fan and enjoyed it. It wasn't the same, but you know, it was.
So you watched the entire series all the way through, even after you left.
I did. Because I was a fan first. So, every episode.
But you don't wish, even though you could have been in that position, you don't wish, I should have gotten a crack at this one.
No.
I do wonder, though, just because you were with the show at such an early time,
mm-hmm.
and by that time, some of those story instincts might have become second nature. I don't know if there's anyone who was in season on the staff for season 2 that was there for season 7 as well.
But. No, in season 5, it was, I think it was an entirely new writing staff.
Yeah.
And then those people, a lot of those people lasted through to season 7.
Right.
So,
Rebecca Sinclair
and
Rosenthal in season 6.
Absolutely, all wonderful writers. Jenny Snyder, Ehrman, I think was there for a year. Yeah, so, no, really great writers. But no, there is no part of me that wishes that. Again, you know, to me it was really a litmus test. I remember we had a writer, probably season 2, who came in and he's like, I don't know. I mean, I see it's a specific voice, but I think anyone else could run it. And I was just like, oh, then you are not hearing what I'm hearing. You know, like, it was like, no, I can do a reasonable facsimile of Amy and Dan's voices, but it's not the same at all.
Right.
At all. It's so specifically them. So,
like, you can't mimic my literal voice any, you know what I mean? Like,
exactly.
Unless you're a master or whatever the equivalent would be.
No, I would have no desire to do that.
But when they offered you the exec producer, that was for season 6, because that was at the end of season 5. Because what would that have entailed for, like, what were the duties or responsibilities?
It was unclear. I mean, I remember them, they were so kind, and they're like, and you'll sit at the head of the table with us, and you'll be in on everything. And, I think it would have been shadowing them a lot. My guess would be they knew that there was a chance they wouldn't be there season 7, and they were probably hoping to kind of, you know, not mentor, that's the wrong word, but to have someone really shadow them to try to, because it's still, you know, it's, I mean, that show is so them. And I think, you know, in their ideal world, even if with them gone, if they could have gotten it as close to what they created as possible, you know, at least if it were me, that's what I would want. But so maybe they'd hope, kind of by osmosis, had I, you know, been by their side for a whole season, I could have known what to do, you know, if they left. But
right. And that probably would have entailed, because when you were on staff, you were just in the writer's room. That probably would have entailed being in the edit bay, being on set, and being all those other places. It's hard for two people to be everywhere at the same time, because most shows do have executive producers that, like, are in charge of, okay, so you're the guy who makes sure all the direction is, you know, unified.
Absolutely.
But they didn't really have that, did they?
No. Oh, you know, or on a lot of other shows, the writer kind of produces a whole episode. They, you know, in addition to writing it, then they're on set when it's shot, and they go to editing, and they really oversee every step of the entire episode. So it's either that or a producer who kind of oversees everything on set. But no, it was really, we were just about the stories and words.
Stories and words.
We went to set, you know, occasionally when we just needed a break from the from our heads. One time George Lucas visited set, we all made sure we went.
Back up.
Oh yeah.
Hold on. We got our Daniel Paladino moment. Explain that. What if you put Jar Jar in Stars Hollow?
Misa Townie. Oh, man.
Misa Coffee?
George Lucas visited the set of Gilmore Girls?
Visited the set. Sat in a director's chair at Video Village, and I don't remember who the director that week was, but none of us
were
envying her, because it seemed like, oh my gosh, how do you direct with George Lucas sitting in back of you? But he was lovely. He was there because of his daughter. It was his daughter's birthday, and every year he would take her to the set of whatever show she wanted to go to. So she wanted to come see Gilmore Girls.
Of course.
Yeah.
That's exactly what you do if you're George Lucas. You have the clout to go on any
show. Sure.
You want to be in it, kid? You'll be in it.
No, he could not have been nicer, but I just specifically remembered, like, oh, we're going to set. This is a day we are going to set. So, yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, it was amazing.
I'm very surprised that you say writers don't often go to set on the show. Not as if Amy wouldn't have the sort of control to keep that like the same in every situation, but I'm wondering what's the difference between, because you talked a little bit about how writing credits change on this show. What is the difference between like a written by credit and a story credit on this show? Because it doesn't happen every episode that we get a story by credit.
There's not usually any huge difference. Story by on most shows actually is usually just a way of giving like partial credit to someone. Like perhaps if someone had started, you know, had written the outline for the episode,
right,
but then Amy decided she was going to go ahead and write the script, like the drafts of the script, then maybe you just kind of go, okay, well, you'll take story by and I'll take, you know, written by or whatever. I think that was how it was, but it was never like I came in and pitched an idea, so I got the story, and then she took it, and that's why she got written by. It was more just a division of how the division of labor happened. So if you happen to have done a chunk, usually on that show, it was usually because thinking it was going to be yours, and then sometimes the schedule would change, and it was like, oh, Amy's going to be directing, so she won't be able to write the next one, so actually she's going to write the one that you were working on, or whatever. It was yeah, it was just kind of a situational thing.
That's strange to me, because on some episodes they also have co-written credits, and I'm always just confused as to what the difference is.
Co-written, because I had a co-written one that I wrote with Janet Leahy, and I think that was more just timing. As the season goes on, especially, you're usually under the gun. You know, you start with this nice cushion of episodes at the beginning that you wrote over the summer, and then you lose ground each week.
It's just like college.
Exactly.
It's just like school.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's end of the semester from about Christmas on. And so, yeah, I think it's just to turn it around more quickly.
Right.
So co-written, you usually would, both people would work on the outline, and then both people would work on the script and divide it up however you want to. But story by, generally, that person wrote the outline and someone else wrote it.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Now I want to know who else visited set on Gilmore Girls that we don't know about.
Steven Spielberg.
And then Steve Jobs was there. It was Francis Ford Coppola.
Tony Kushner.
Or Kushner. Yeah, sure. Angels in America guy.
Yeah.
No, why not?
Exactly. I bet put him in the show.
Right?
Tony Kushner.
Why not?
Tony Kushner, I'm pregnant. That's what the episode should have been.
That's fantastic. Great.
Tony Kushner, I'm pregnant.
Oh, man.
That'd be amazing. So really then after Gilmore, so you went from Roundhouse to Treehouse.
Or a clubhouse.
Very
nice. Clubhouse.
Yes, close there enough. What else? Yeah. Want to do it again? We'll just...
It's from Roundhouse to clubhouse.
To house.
Exactly.
To house. Hugh Laurie.
Yeah, so Clubhouse was a show about a New York Yankees bat boy based on a real guy and his memoirs.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sweet, but it was a sweet show, and it was canceled after 10 episodes or something. But it was weird because suddenly I was a drama writer and I didn't mean to be. And I was sort of like, I don't know that I know how to write a drama. Like that was the kind of show where obviously like plot really matters and you have act breaks, like they get mugged, act break. And I'm just
wait,
but what about Rory's bracelet? Did we find it? Like, it was such a different thing.
Which is probably something like Ugly Betty was a more comfortable fit because it does mix comedy and drama.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like that.
And also there were a number of people with a comedy background on Ugly Betty, which I think informs the kind of stories you tell. That you can do kind of smaller reality based stories. I'm not saying this well. Again, we'll cut this part out.
Cut this part out is a catchphrase.
I know. I'm getting a pass, right? I get a...
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. So. Okay, good.
Yeah, you get final cut.
I was sure of that.
Well, that's an interesting thing about small stakes versus large stakes. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember where I read this, but it was about why stakes in superhero movies or a lot of franchise movies tend to just be numbing after a while because if everything is the end of the world, then it's going to be fine.
Yeah, yeah.
So every climax of a Marvel movie, don't worry about it. It'll be okay. But when stakes are smaller, when stories are smaller and more emotional, You know, like Breaking Bad covered how much land in Albuquerque, New Mexico. That's essentially, even though there's guns and shooting or whatever, it's a small stake show. And the smaller and smaller you get, I think the more and more resonant it becomes with an audience.
Yes.
And that's why something like Gilmore or things like Ugly Betty and Bunheads become more reflective and people say, oh, I see myself in that, because smaller stakes are easier to invest in and easier to just see yourself in.
More relatable,
as well.
For sure. And I think there's absolutely a place for other kinds of storytelling as well. But just in terms of what I feel I am suited for, those smaller stories are the ones that I like telling. So, and on Ugly Betty, I think about it a lot because I'm just that big a TV nerd. I try to think, like, what happened? Because I think season one of that show was really good and then not so much in seasons two, three, and four. And I do think part of it was, not all of it, but part of it was, it's in season two, we started skewing it more toward the comedy side. It had, in season one, it had been a little more drama, some mystery. Again, things to act break on. But then once we were having, it was a six-act show, and having to like gin up five big comedy act breaks then just got silly. So then, like, instead of the thing I care about, which is like, oh, is the cute boy going to like Betty? It was like, oh no, the photo shoot is ruined. You know, Giselle got a pimple. Like, what? I don't know. It just, it was sort of like, oh, now it's just silly. So I don't know. I am not a huge fan of the six act structure that we have drifted
toward. I was about to ask, because was there, we talked about this with Jane a little bit. Was there a time where it was five acts and now it's six acts, or was it six acts and now it's five?
No, it's six now. It's always getting more because they want more commercials. Right. So and bigger stuff happening, I guess. But no, Gilmore was four.
Gilmore was four for sure.
And then and then sometimes it was like a cold open in four or five, and now it is on most networks. It's six. And that's tough. And
it's kind of exhausting as a viewer.
It's really exhausting, and it makes for really choppy storytelling, and you don't really get to get into things as much as you want to. I think it actually has genuinely hurt the quality of network television. And half hours are generally four acts. So it's, it's hard to...
When they used to be three.
Yeah, three or even two. Mad About You, we could go, we had somehow the freedom to go back and forth between two and three, depending on what the story dictated. Yeah. Imagine that.
Imagine that. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Well, because Bunheads was 6X, right?
It must have been. I don't remember now. Yeah.
So, let's talk about that a little bit.
Even, but yeah.
So Bunheads was 2012 to 2013, RIP, which we are, I don't know if you know, but we're going to cover it after we do Gilmore.
Are you really?
Yeah, we're going to go through episode by episode.
Oh my God.
So we should have you on again for the
episode
you wrote or something.
I love that. What's the title of the show going to be, though? Is it still Gilmore Guys?
Well,
do Bunheads?
I don't know.
Boyheads?
I think Bunhead Boys.
Bunhead Boys or Bunhead Bros are the two up for contention.
Nice.
But I think the technicality of whether it's still in the Gilmore Guys feed, you know?
I think it should be.
It should literally just be the same
I think
general
title.
So you don't have to send people to another thing.
A new thing.
So right, Bunhead
good.
Boys or Bunhead
out.
Bros.
Okay,
yeah.
good.
Yeah.
I'm
thank
glad
thank
doing
you
it.
For workshopping this with us.
No problem.
You are a writer. So that was kind of a situation of getting the old band back together, because Amy and Dan ran the show, and then you came back. I don't know if... Were there other former Gilmore writers that did that show?
Not writers. No, they didn't. They didn't have much budget. You know, being an ABC Family show, they did not have budget for higher level writers. So it was Amy, Dan, me, and then a lot of staff writers, you know, just baby writers, where it was like their first or second writing credit. So and that was just dictated by budget.
When you started work on that again, was that kind of like getting into the time machine and like, oh wow, this is very, or were there like marked differences in working for a lower budget show, ABC Family, not WB,
right,
on a show that only lasted one season and kind of a weird scheduling structure, right? Because it was like 10 episodes and
seasons,
then eight.
1A and 1B, which is a weird thing that they do to not have to give anyone their second season pay bumps.
It's totally pay, right?
Yeah, it is.
That's why
it
Breaking is. Bad is, Splendid I don't know why I'm referencing too. Breaking Bad so much, but Breaking Bad, it was season five, and then it was the final season. It wasn't season six, it was 5B, essentially, because they don't want to give Cranston $400K an episode or whatever.
And everyone, I mean, I think most people, I know writers, but I also think a lot of the crew, everyone is, you know, but if you have a contract, it's usually bumps per season. So, we'll just make one season last, season 1Z we're on.
So smaller, less money, less sets. Was there, how much did that dictate story, budget-wise?
Oh, a fair amount. I mean, we were very aware of what we could accomplish shooting-wise. And the fact that we were lucky we had a great exterior where we shot a few days per episode, Calamigos Ranch, which is where the studio was and any of the, you know, outside walking scenes you saw. And they had a lot of structures there that we could use for different purposes. And that was a godsend. But no, we really, it was a short shoot schedule. I mean, it was 7 days and still with.
Because usually you have eight.
Yeah, eight or, gosh, Ugly Betty read 9 or 10. I mean, it was, yeah.
It's ABC money.
I know, right? So, it was challenging. We definitely had to just be mindful of producibility of our scripts.
Sure.
So
the actual studio set, that was on. Was that a set or was that the ranch?
I'm trying to think. The exterior, I don't even remember. Because we had the interior on our stages.
Okay.
Because I know there's a big deal with the floor that the dancers needed. And yeah, I think Amy herself had it put in so that they had a good dance floor. But there was stuff we had the exterior of the studio and some other things out at the ranch. I don't remember exactly.
Right.
So.
But writing for Kelly Bishop again.
Miss
awesome. Fanny Flowers.
Fantastic.
All that jazz.
So good. So good. And Sutton Foster, who there are not enough good things in the world to say about her. She can do anything and is unbelievably nice and incredibly hardworking. I have a friend who is her personal assistant now, and I am determined, like, find something bad. Find a human flaw. Because I have yet to see it. She's amazing.
I know. We met her briefly at ATX, and she was very lovely.
Oh, nice. Yeah. And the girls were great, too. It was a lot of fun.
It was, you know, because I think oftentimes, anytime you do something that's a hit, and that's the big thing, anything you do afterwards is going to be compared to that.
Yeah.
So oftentimes, Bunheads, it was like, okay, it's Kelly Bishop again. It's a fast-talking woman. But I see so many of the stories on Bunheads being so distinct from what Gilmore was. And especially even the protagonist being much less mature, obviously in a lot of ways, than Lorelai even was.
Mm-hmm.
How did you guys, did the way you broke story for Bunheads, was that significantly different than it was for Gilmore? What was the directive for
I'm
that
trying to think.
Overall?
I am not even sure, but we definitely didn't break in quite as much detail. Still a lot of detail, but not quite as much. You know, that I feel like as a show, you know, it was only two half seasons, so I don't even know, like, which would be the equivalent of that reportedly terrible first season internally of Gilmore. So I think we were still sort of finding our stride and figuring out what worked for this show. So I don't know that we had landed on the way to do an episode. I think it was probably one way for this and one way there. And then some other things happened and, you know, throw this one together. And then this one we got to spend a lot of time on. And that, you know, I don't think there was a way of doing things there.
Gotcha. Because it wasn't enough time to get things dialed in.
Yeah. And again, it was, you know, and the writers were great, but it was an inexperienced staff, you know, just again, budget. And then as always, Amy and Dan have, need to be in a lot of places at once. And, so yeah, it was a show that was still kind of finding itself. So, and that is one where we certainly were aware that it may be going away. And I think there was thought about that when we ended it, like knowing that that could be the series finale.
So, oh, okay. So that did affect
it. It was in our minds, just that was a possibility. I don't know that it necessarily dictated the story, but we certainly were aware of it. So. Yeah.
Such a shame.
I know.
I get sad every time I talk about Bunheads.
Aww.
Well, because, you know, it was like, we talked about it with Sean Gunn, actually, who was on the show as the barista. And it seemed, and he put it so well, it seemed to be like right at this cusp where it's like on-demand streaming and all this stuff is occurring. And that's pretty mainstream now. And everyone watches stuff on Amazon Prime or Hulu or Netflix. But the idea that networks would invest and have initial loss to invest in a library of scripted show for a catalog that is profitable over time.
Right.
Like, that was almost there. Like, you know, why FX will renew The Americans for like 5 seasons to not very good ratings. Or, you know, because over time, that's what's most profitable. And Bunheads was just in that.
Just a little too early.
It was a little too early, it felt like.
I hadn't thought of it that way, but I think you're absolutely
right. Just a little bit ahead of its time.
Absolutely right. Yeah, which is too bad. It was, I would have liked to have seen where that show went, you know, had it been able to
like get more into Paradise. And
yeah,
I will say though, one of the most, and I'm sure we'll talk about Bunhead Bros or Boys or whichever one it is, it was, even though it was super low budget, like you were saying, parts of it are technically dazzling in terms of amazing. Even just with that simple studio set and not having the camera guys reflected in any of the mirrors.
I don't know how they
like
did that.
It's like a weird... That was what I was going to ask. How did they do that?
I was there and I don't know. I have no idea. Amy has a real gift for... Yeah, probably. But no, I think also just in the reality. I don't recall seeing cameras even in many of the dailies. But Amy has a gift for getting people's absolute best work out of them. Mm-hmm. She is really good at surrounding herself with good people. And somehow, just like everyone wants to do their best for her. I mean, everyone is so in awe of her talent and her vision, which is always so strong. And it's rare that you get to work for someone like that who knows so completely what they want. And I don't even know how to put it, but like really believes that everyone around her can do this. Like, I mean, that she knows she's asking for a lot, but she also wouldn't ask if she didn't know you couldn't do it, you know?
Right.
And she on this show, it was interesting, though. I think she did feel kind of guilty that it was so low budget. She had so many talented people. The choreographer, Marguerite Derricks, was amazing. The costumers, just everyone. There were a lot of really talented people who I'm pretty certain, I don't know, but it seemed like everyone had to take pay cuts to go to ABC Family. Well, Amy felt so badly that everyone was doing this. She was buying us food trucks on such a regular basis, like just as a way to like, just eat, I'll give you food. Like, she's so incredibly generous.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a random note out at Calamigos Ranch, that exterior where we shot. Mm-hmm. The Biggest Loser also shot there. So it was always kind of horrifying that we'd have all of our like ice cream sandwich trucks and hot dog trucks and quesadilla trucks.
And teeny tiny ballerinas eating them.
Yes, exactly. And the Biggest Loser people are, you know, jogging by.
It was
awful. So awful.
Oh, no.
And wonderful.
Maybe it was on purpose.
Maybe.
Well, that's interesting, too, because I feel like, I don't know how to describe this, but Amy Sherman-Palladino, as she exists on this show, because it's like Gilmore Girls is her voice and her vision and her and Daniel working together. She almost exists as like a who's like a famous character that is always spoken of but never seen in like a movie, like
a legend.
Like, did you hear the president's coming today? Like, I feel like we're painting her in outline without actually ever talking with her.
Right.
What is something the public perception is like a visionary, someone who works hard and knows exactly what she wants, someone who demands a lot from people and gets a lot from people, someone who has a strong vision for strong women characters and all that jazz, someone who wears crazy hats and dresses however she wants. What is something, you know, within boundaries, what is something that we may not know about the kind of showrunner, writer, person that Amy is, that I think people would benefit from in enjoying Gilmore Girls?
Oh, my goodness. That is such a good question.
I mean, the food truck stuff.
I wish I could honor it with a good answer.
Oh, sure.
Well, no, but the food trucks does make me think. I think people don't know that she is the most generous showrunner I've ever worked for. Like, on my birthday on Bunheads, she got a masseuse on set and my favorite food truck. She got the
which was why? What was your favorite food
crepin
truck?
Crepin' Around. It's a crepes truck. Which I
Crepin' Around.
Creeping Around. Got it.
Oh, actually, I never even got that. I'm like, what is that? Crepin' Around. Thank you. Okay, thank you. But anyway, they have good crepes. The four cheese one, especially, if you ever get a chance. But anyway, the fact like that was huge that she did that. Or anytime, you know, if I've ever had a family situation or whatever, it's just always like, go, no, you've got to go do that. That's more important. Or what? Like, she's very, I know she wouldn't want to see herself as maternal, but she actually does have, she likes to, or does a good job of taking care of the people around her.
Sure.
And I think maybe people don't know that. They see the eccentric big personality. And I do think you get a very strong sense of who she is from watching her shows.
Right.
Lorelai talks the way Amy talks. Actually, Stars Hollow talks the way Amy talks. So.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's funny that you mentioned that about maternal instincts, mm-hmm. because I think one thing maybe we've talked about this on the show. I forget, but it's so funny that for a show that the core of it is mothers and daughters mm-hmm. and family relating to each other, it's mostly being, and this is not a criticism, but it's mm-hmm. just an interesting thing. Amy herself is not a mother. Mm-hmm. Lauren Graham's not a mother. Kelly's not a mother. Mm-hmm. Alexis is not a mother. So it's like this interesting, and I guess I would ask for you, mm-hmm. like, were you a mother while working on the show, or did that come
later?
Not
at the time. That was okay. later. Yeah. Yeah.
So how do you think, and I don't know if you've revisited the show since having children of your own, but has that like changed the way you view the show, or do you see like different truths in it that yeah. maybe you didn't see before?
I haven't revisited, and I also have two boys, so it's a totally different thing.
Oh,
but
sure.
I think all of those people you mentioned aren't mothers have mothers. So if you haven't had the experience of being the mother, you've certainly had a mother, so you've at least experienced half of the relationship. And I think you can extrapolate from that what it would be like to be on the other side of it.
Mm-hmm.
And also, a lot of it, certainly in Lorelai Rory, I think there's a strong fantasy element to that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It's anyone could imagine, like, if I had a daughter, I would want it to be Rory. I would want that
of
relationship.
Course.
I would want to be best friends. I would want, So I think, I don't think that relationship exists that often in reality. So I don't think it's
right.
I don't think we're missing anything by not having been mothers writing the show. We were all daughters.
That's true.
So
yeah, it's just like Danny Strong,
mm-hmm.
who's Doyle on the show,
of course,
and then
yes.
he writes Empire.
His humble beginnings.
Exactly, yeah.
Wow.
It's pretty amazing. But sometimes people say, well, you're writing Empire.
Yeah.
And you're not obviously in hip hop culture, mm-hmm. you're not African American yourself. Mm-hmm. He's like, yeah, Martin Scorsese's not a gangster. That's a slightly different analogy, but
again, you can usually draw from some element of your experience.
Right.
we all have relationships with people,
right.
And it may not be a mother-daughter relationship, but elements of even a friend relationship that you have that are somehow applicable to this. So, again, I said this earlier, and I think I stole it from Bruce Springsteen, actually, but I really believe
in... Are you a Bruce Springsteen fan?
A little bit. A little bit.
Well, we need to talk.
Oh, we'll talk.
Kevin is the biggest.
Okay. See, I can't go toe-to-toe on that
because
I'm a California girl, so it's not like in my blood.
Oh, sure. Yeah,
but in my adult life, I have enjoyed going to the concerts.
Mm-hmm.
I love going to his concerts more than almost anything. But anyway, he had said once, he was asked about his songwriting and how much is autobiographical, and he's the one who said it's emotionally autobiographical. So it's not the specifics, but it's the emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that applies for writing characters, too, who aren't necessarily in the exact same relationship or situation that I have been in my life, but I can imagine and fill in based on similar things. So,
man, yeah. I love any guest that would quote Bruce Springsteen back to me.
Nice.
That is...
I would not have pegged you for a Springsteen fan.
Really?
Yeah,
I don't know
why.
The way I'm dressed, I don't know.
We'll talk.
Wait, when was the last show you went to?
It was here. It was here.
Oh, so it was at the sports arena?
Uh-huh.
2012?
Yes,
I was there.
Yes. Nice. That was you.
That was me. Yes. I was the wearer wearing a American flag t-shirt it's Bruce, it's Kermit the Frog instead of Bruce Springsteen.
No way.
That's a real thing that I own and wear at every Bruce show.
Great.
That's fantastic. I have to. Oh, and this is so not going to play on a podcast.
That's fine.
But I'm fortunate enough to be kind of visible to Clarence Clemens, rest in peace. The last time I saw him, and
yeah.
he made eye contact with me and went thump thump on his heart and pointed
yes.
at me. Oh yeah.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
That was a very good moment.
Oh, rest in peace.
Or the woman in back of me, but I think it was.
We'll say it's you.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah, talk about connecting to an audience.
Mm.
I like this, but there's some Springsteen references in Gilmore's stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know if Dan or Amy is more
of
a Springsteen fan.
Yeah, they're not huge fans. I mean, I think they probably respect his work enough, but it's not one of their go-tos.
I know they err more on the side of Tom Waits than
absolutely.
Bruce.
Absolutely.
Picture in a Frame.
That was amazing.
So good. Can't wait to get to it.
Amazing.
Well, man, what else do we want to cover? Mm. More fun George Lucas stories, behind the scenes tidbits, me accidentally shaming people for not being mothers, which I was not trying shaming? To do. I hope it didn't come off like that.
It didn't at all. Good. Oh my goodness. No, not even a little.
good.
That's hilarious.
I'm curious about the difference in the writing process between Bunheads and Gilmore Girls. As someone who worked on both, did you see a change in like how the writer's room worked or how like the difference in what input Amy gave to scripts as opposed to what was kept from writers or changed?
In general, it was fairly similar. I will say the biggest difference is unfortunately, it's just specific to me. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how interesting it is for anyone else. But, you know, when I did Gilmore, I was still a fairly young, inexperienced writer and had certainly never done hour long and didn't know Amy's style or whatever. And so I felt like I was a little bit like deer in the headlights all the time. And, you know, there may have been tears shed, you know, now and then, like feeling like I don't know what I'm doing. And it was nice professionally and personally to be asked to come do this by Amy. She was very lovely about saying, you're the only one I want for this. You know, may have said it to five other people before she said that to me, but she was really, really went out of her way to make that work for me. In fact, I was working on Desperate Housewives at the time and she's like, I'll wait. That's okay. I'll wait. So, you know, they started a month before I was even available and she waited, you know, let me start late. Wow. And it was nice just personally to be in a different place with her, to have, you know, I went and worked on a whole lot of other shows and, you know, felt like, oh, now I can bring a little more experience to the table and hopefully even be more helpful to her than in the past. I know what she likes and what she wants. And I also then have the experience now to back that up. And so it was nice. I felt like our personal relationship had changed a little bit. In terms of the scripts and the rewriting of most of the staff, I mean, that was still the same. It was still very heavily rewritten by Amy. Mm-hmm. But again, we never, because that show was so short-lived, we didn't ever get to a point where it was like, oh, okay, this is how an episode of Bunheads is written. Because it sort of changed from week to week. And even from season 1A to 1B, season 1A, Dan was not that involved. And in season 1B, he was around a lot more.
Oh,
and
interesting.
Then, I think a lot happens, you know, between the two of them over dinner that, you know, we're not privy to, but they figure out a lot of stuff on their own. Mm-hmm. And so so we don't see that part of the process, you know. I wish I had a better answer for that, but it just,
that's a great answer.
We hadn't gotten there yet with that show, so.
No.
Anyway.
I cannot wait to do Bunheads because me, Bunheads is like this weirdly hidden gem because it's not available on streaming services. Like you can buy it on iTunes and you can buy it on Amazon Prime, but you can't stream it from like Netflix.
Do you know if movies are available?
They're not.
Ugh.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
I feel
surprised.
Like if I'm buying it, I really want to have a physical.
So it's real tough. Absolutely. Yeah, I know. Like that's the thing. Well, I think Amy even commented about that in ATX. She was talking to someone at ABC Family about getting on DVD. And then that person got fired.
Oh, no.
So who knows where the conversation is now.
Oh, wow.
But we're definitely going to get into it.
I'm thrilled you guys are doing that. Thank you.
Well, Sheila, thank you so much. What are you working on now? What do you want to plug?
I have nothing to plug. I'm actually taking development meetings right now and thinking about writing a pilot. So stay tuned.
Two young boys who start a podcast.
I like it. I can see it.
They're different, but they complement each other. Oh, man. Yeah. Well, are you on social media? Do you have anything to follow? Or
No. I am really old. Remember me? I'm the one who audio taped things when I was a child.
That's true.
So, no.
Kick it old school.
I stopped at Facebook. I'm like, enough. I can't do anymore. I can't. And
that's
I know
fair.
That's ridiculous. It's not. And I know better. And I should just get over that. But I'm like, no, done. I'm just done right here. So,
I think that's a good plateau, though, where you're just like, don't need it. And you can be comfortable not needing it.
I think so. I will be uncomfortable again. I'm just that neurotic. In about a day or two, I'll be like, oh my gosh, what did I do? Let me come back and record my, you know, Twitter handle feed. I don't know.
Oh, we'll just insert it digital.
Yeah, exactly.
Your handle feed. Yeah, we'll put it in there. It's a beautiful world on Twitter.
I know it is.
Yeah, there's some good stuff.
There's some good stuff.
There's some beautiful sections
right.
of Twitter. Demi and I would not know each other without Twitter.
Wow. Yeah.
For example.
Okay. I know it's lovely, but I would have to give up something else in my life to make room for it, like one of my children or something. So I don't know that I'm ready. I don't know that I'm ready.
Oh, no. Well, if you have to sacrifice your
Sheila's
child.
Choice.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's a Sheila's choice.
Yeah.
That's true. Well, then we'll do the thing that we do usually in episodes where, because Gilmore Girls is so about pop culture and what the girls are always watching, listening, reading, What is one thing in pop culture or media, a TV show or a movie or book that you're reading that you're really enjoying right now?
I just watched Catastrophe on Amazon, which I really enjoyed.
A plus.
I love Sharon Horgan. Mm-hmm. I loved her BBC series Pulling. Was fantastic. I love the script for Divorce, the HBO show with Sarah Jessica Parker. She wrote that. I thought Catastrophe was great. Again, that's an example of a half hour that's not jokey like a network show has to be, not act-breaky. And it's just completely delightful.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's my latest.
That show is actually very Gilmore, if you think about it, because it's like big personal conflicts, but not big, big conflicts and done naturalistically.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
It's a beautiful show. Yeah. Love Catastrophe.
Me too.
Oh, you can follow us, Kevin T. Porter, Electro Lemon, whatever. And could I sound less enthused?
Yeah.
Wow. Take another sip of your latte. You're so close to the end.
What were you going to say?
No, I was going to jokingly plug something. I was just, never mind.
Oh, all right.
I don't have nothing. I got nothing to plug.
Not yet.
Watch Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. That's still my plug.
Okay, sure. We'll go with that. Well, Sheila, thank you so much for joining us and chatting about this show. Thank you for helping create this show that has gone on to entertain millions of people for so many years and a bunch of other shows you made too.
Thank you for
Roundhouse.
Oh, thank you. I'm going to try
and
find
Clubhouse.
It for you. And House.
Thank you for Work With Me.
Nice callback. But now I'm getting nervous. I know you used the word create very generally, but
sure.
I'm like, no, that's all. It's all Amy.
Thank you
for being the sole creator and sole writer.
Thank you for writing every line of dialogue.
You yourself said. Amy who?
Amy who? That sounds like an ABC
who
show.
Amy?
Who Amy? It's been another Gilmore Gab. We've gotten two writers. We're going to catch them all one day. We're talking John Stevens. We're talking Rebecca, maybe. Sinclair. We'll get them all. Oh, hell yeah. Thanks again, Sheila. And now we'll play the tape you made in seventh grade.
Get it.
Here we go.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.